I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest in this archive edition of Midday, the novelist Alice McDermott. 20 years ago, she won the National Book Award for her bestseller, Charming Billy, and she has held a place in the upper echelons of American literary fiction ever since. In novels like After This and Someone, McDermott demonstrates a profound capacity for insight into the nooks and crannies of the human soul, placing before us ostensibly unexceptional characters with exceptional grace and power. Her latest novel takes us inside a community of Catholic nuns in early 20th century Brooklyn. The lives they touch and the lives they live create a fascinating window into the human heart. It's called The Ninth Hour. Our show is on tape, so we can't take your calls. Alice McDermott, up next on this archive edition of Midday, right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. So glad you're with us. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall, and my guest today is the novelist Alice McDermott. She is the New York Times bestselling author of 8 terrific novels. She's also published short stories and essays in The New Yorker, Harper's, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and elsewhere. 3 of her novels, After This, At Weddings and Wakes, and That Night, were finalists for the Pulitzer Prize. Another novel, Charming Billy, won the National Book Award in 1998. Her latest novel, published just last month, is a profound and moving contemplation on the big issues: love, family, faith, religion, and bringing meaning to one's life. Set in early 20th century Brooklyn, we meet a community of Catholic nuns, the Little Nursing Sisters of the Sick Poor Congregation of Mary Before the Cross, Stabat Mater. The nuns are an eclectic mix of personalities who are devoted to an amazing regimen of selfless charity, tending to the quotidian needs of people that they encounter in their most vulnerable state. The circle of these nuns is expanded in the novel to include a cast of lay characters who bring to the story generous dollops of joy and complication and beauty. The story is told with tenderness and compassion by an artist who seems, to this reader at least, at the height of her creative and literary powers. The novel is called The Ninth Hour. And Alice McDermott, it is so fun to see you always. So welcome back.
Thank you so much, Tom. Great to be here.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, if you, like me, are a big fan of Alice McDermott's novels, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and to find us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. So you really do take on, and this is not the first time you've done this, but in this novel, you take on these huge notions: religion, faith, love, family. I mean, taking on the big stuff, that always works out well, doesn't it? Right? I suppose all great novelists are attracted to the great themes, but when you tackle something, you know, as complicated and historically difficult as those kinds of themes, I mean, what kind of challenges does that present to you as a writer?
Oh my! Well, thank you. Thank you for the kind words. I think for most readers, and this one included, when you talk about themes, suddenly you're back in high school English class.
Right.
And what is it? Man versus man, man versus self, man versus universe. That doesn't sound like any fun at all. but I think these are the things that fiction is required to deal with. I mean, where else do we go to think about the big questions anymore? We seem to live so much on the surface of things, and our heads whipping back and forth through the next tweet or the next news cycle. And so I think of, you know, fiction as a place to go to get away, and also to not only get a story — we all want a story — but also to consider these things, to take time to consider these things.
And you consider them in a very nuanced way, you always have. And your characters are more often than not not famous.
Yes.
I mean, they're not sort of people who've come in some, you know, gargantuan way change the course of the universe. They're quote unquote normal people. They're quiet people. They're people that are in a certain way of looking at, from a certain perspective, unexceptional. but their lives and what they endure and conquer and figure out and enjoy are, of course, what we all share, famous or not.
Well, that comes with being human. There's no one else like us. That means each and every one of us. And the nice thing about writing about, at least having a fair number of nuns in this particular novel, someone mentioned to me last night that there are lots of women in this novel, and their physical beauty is never mentioned, nor is it required to define them. And that sort of took me by surprise. It's absolutely true, but I can't say that I was aware of that. It's just they had so many other things that were interesting to me about their vocations and the circumstances of their lives and their selflessness and even for the lay women, how they figured out how to get through life without a social safety net, that it didn't consciously occur to me that beauty is just not in the mix here.
Yeah, that very thought occurred to me, so I'm glad someone else had it. And there's also just a paucity of men characters. There's not all that many men in this book, which is fine. And the nuns, there's something about nuns. I mean, I'm a lapsed Catholic. I was raised Catholic. I was talking to Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie about this because their religion plays very heavily in her first novel, which we talked about a month ago. And you know Chimamanda.
Sure.
She's actually a former student of
That's
yours.
That's right, at Hopkins, yeah,
which
yes.
is terrific. And there's just something about, no, I'm a sucker for nuns, I got to tell you. I just really am. I mean, always have been since the first grade. And what's also interesting, having known a couple of communities of nuns growing up in various different states, they are a very eclectic mix. It's a different mix. Nuns are not anything close to monolithic.
No. Well, they're humans. You know, it's just that's why every character, if you look carefully enough, will soon strike you as unique. And I have to say, I mean, I was sort of surprised this became a novel about nuns. Surprised and also dismayed as someone who's tried to duck the Catholic novelist label for seven novels and then realizing, oh, God,
This is it. Brittany Spears
Right.
So profoundly
exactly.
said.
Yeah, right. I admit it. This one is a Catholic novel.
Breaking news, ladies and gentlemen. Alice McDermott is my guest. Her new novel is called The Ninth Hour. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. To join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and to find us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. I was put in mind of a poem by an English romantic poet, 19th century, Gerard Manley Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And do you know this poem by any chance? Heaven Haven, A Nun Takes the Veil?
Yes.
Do you know
yes,
this poem?
Yes.
Since it's short,
yes.
I'm going to read it
Please
for folks.
Please do, yeah.
This is A Nun Takes the Veil. I have desired to go where springs not fail, to fields where flies no sharp or sided hail, and a few lilies blow. And I have asked to be where no storms come, where the green swell is in the havens dumb and out of the swing of the sea. I just love that.
Gorgeous
poem.
Stuff.
I came to that poem through music. Uh-huh. I conducted a musical
oh,
setting
my
of
gosh.
It by
well,
Sam
Hopkins,
Barber.
Yes.
You know, and Hopkins is a very frequent librettist for a number of choral pieces. But of course, this describes a nun who's kind of, you know, taking the vocation to recede from the
yes,
world.
Yes.
The nuns in this novel, they ain't receding from nothing.
Not at all, no. And the order of nuns that I deal with is my own. I had to create an order.
It's a great name.
There were all kinds of orders out there in the real world, but none of them quite fit my purposes. But I was really conscious of making my order a nursing order and not a teaching order. I think all the stereotypes and cliches of nuns that we get in popular culture are filtered through grammar school eyes of those of us who remember being in a class with 50 or 60 kids and a nun screaming at the front of the classroom. But I also wanted to show these nuns engaged in the world. That's actually how they got into the novel in the first place, because I had a situation that I had written of a young Irish immigrant taking his own life and leaving a wife who was expecting. And at that time and place, as I say, without a social safety net, who would be there to take charge of this woman's life but the nursing sisters in the neighborhood?
Yeah, and she ends up living with them, and she has this baby. And they, of course, jump in when everyone is in extreme distress. I mean, they find people in the neighborhood, they find people all through Brooklyn who just are needy, and they say, okay, we'll do it. And they roll up their sleeves, and they go in and they do it. But they enter the vocation for different reasons. I mean, and there, as you say, there are different vocations. I mean,
yes.
There's nursing, there's teaching, there's contemplative,
yes.
The Carmelites. We have a wonderful Carmelite monastery here in Baltimore. So there's a different take on a lot of different orders. But they enter the vocation. They decide on this life for different reasons, and they come out of different circumstances. And you beautifully illuminate what those reasons are through the course of the book. But that's what makes it so much fun, that they're all there for different reasons, but they end up sort of doing the same thing.
They are. And for this order in particular, and again, it's an amalgam of historical orders who were out on the streets. There were thousands of nuns in the Brooklyn area in the early part of the 20th century, and hundreds of orders. It's absolutely amazing to see what the numbers were. But the thing that I found sort of engaging, and which sort of reconciled my own hesitation to write a book about nuns. Well, I loved the way they named themselves. You know, one of the nice things that Catholicism gives you is great language. We have good words, and we put them together in interesting ways. And so the idea of the Little Nursing Sisters of the Sick Poor, Congregation of Mary Before the Cross, sort of embodies something about all these women who do that. There's that marvelous humility. A lot of the orders use little and small and humble. That don't notice us. We're just little. We're just little sisters, and we're going to take it. And then the end of the order is of the sick poor. And the end of the order is about their ambition. So in their naming of themselves, they acknowledge their humility. Don't pay any attention to us. We're just going to go about our work, but we're going to stand against human suffering. That's what we're out to do.
No
little task. So, you think about who would these women be who would take the veil, become nondescript, become one of a community, and yet would have such either confidence or faith or ambition.
Chutzpah.
Exactly.
You know, really.
To say, I'm going to go out there and I am going to take care of this suffering thing. I'm going to do the best I can to stand against all human suffering. How could they not be interesting people?
Yeah, yeah. And what's fascinating as well is that a Catholic church, which is known for its patriarchy, it's known for its, men-centered everything. I mean, the nuns are nuns. They're never going to be priests, at least probably not in our lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, but the power and the influence and the significance of these women to the church, I mean, it's just it's immeasurable.
Yes, and again, these were the representatives of the church who were going into the homes. They were going into the homes to nurse the sick, to take care of the children. These nuns would clean the house. They would do grocery shopping if the mother was ill or missing. They would take the clothes and launder them and bring them back. They would bring whatever the family needed. They were there, sort of on the ground, in and out of the homes, and embodying the words of Christ in a way that the priests were immune from. They were, you know, they were not active in that way.
Yeah, they put on the fancy cassock and surplice and, you know, stood on the altar and went out to lunch and preached the preaching. But, you know, and when they weren't doing that, when they weren't caring for the individuals, they were on the street with a basket and an outstretched hand collecting alms, collecting, begging for the money to be able to support what they were doing.
Right.
Yeah, it's a fascinating life, and they're fascinating people. Great book. We're going to take a little bit break, and then we will come back and talk more about it. Alice McDermott is here. The new novel is called The Ninth Hour. She's the Richard A. Maxey Professor of the Humanities at Johns Hopkins University, where she has taught writing since 1996. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. And thanks for joining us again. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation about hate crimes on college campuses. The Prince George's County State's Attorney has decided to charge a 22-year-old white student, Sean Urbanski, with a hate crime in the stabbing death last spring of a black 23-year-old Army Second Lieutenant, Richard W. Collins III. There has been a rash of hate incidents on several local and national college campuses, and the Maryland State Police just released their report on incidences of bias in 2016. The trend is not good. We'll talk about it with Lawrence Ross, the author of Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses, and University of Maryland student Ashley Vasquez, plus a conversation with artist David Brewster about his new exhibit at the Maryland Historical Society that explores issues of race, gender, and bias. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest for the hour is the acclaimed National Book Award-winning novelist Alice McDermott. We're talking about her beautiful new novel, The Ninth Hour. You are welcome to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones to begin this segment. Patricia in Ellicott City, thanks for your call. Welcome to Midday with Alice McDermott.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk with Ms. McDermott. She's my favorite author at this point, and I just wanted to call to say that, to tell her how much pleasure she has given me. And the next to the last one, Someone, I thought was just so appealing. The family was, you know, really came to life for me. And I remember two scenes. They were really so well presented. The one in which the son used to declaim after dinner for the family, and how the whole family just listened, you know, with so much love and respect. And then finally, the one that I remember is the impromptu meal that the mother fixed for the young man and her daughter, the one that she finally found, the someone she finally found. It was just a lovely novel, Miss McDermott, and I just thank you so much for all the pleasure that you have given and all the truthfulness that you brought out. I'm not so much interested in the church, although the church does appear in.
Yep. Well, we seem to have lost Patricia, but we got the gist. And
Patricia,
I'm with you too, kiddo. Let me tell you.
Thank you so much for the lovely words. Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to have people, you know, be able to tell you that, you know, your work is really significant to them. That's really terrific.
Well, you know, when it comes right down to it, it's just reader and writer, just the two of us at any given time.
Yeah.
And so the fact that you can hear from a reader and understand that we have shared this experience. That's created in the book. That's really what you're out for.
Yeah, well, Patricia, I would definitely recommend The Ninth Hour. It is about nuns, but it's about a whole lot more than that. You know, you talk about the language that the Catholic Church gives us to describe the world and put it in perspective. Our producer, Kathleen Cahill, came up with an interesting observation, and that is that perhaps English doesn't have a word that is the opposite of sentimental.
Hmm.
She says, you know, unsentimental just simply means the absence of sentimentality.
Right.
You know? But do we have a way of describing something that is, you know, wholly with not sentimental. It's interesting. I hadn't thought. Had you ever thought of that? That was a new idea to me, which was used to me about an hour ago, and I haven't.
Well, people probably use realistic or authentic, but that's probably not precise because in a realistic world, the sentimental exists. So it's not a precise opposite either.
Because these nuns are in certain ways. Very unsentimental in a lot of situations. At one point, one of them says, never waste your sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
So they're taking care of these people who are just, at the nadir of their lives. They're just, everything possibly go wrong has gone wrong. But, let's be real about this. They're tough cookies with some of their patients and some of their clients,
But there's a lot to be done. For any group that says we're going to go out there and we're going to alleviate suffering, they're going to be busy for the rest of their lives.
They're also willing to sort of to try when they can to bend the rules a little bit. And the Catholic Church certainly is a place with a lot of rules. And the nuns, at one point one nun says, if I ran this church, it'd be a lot different. And I've known nuns like that. I think any Catholic has, certainly, and maybe non-Catholics too. So the novel begins with a suicide. And of course, in the Catholic Church, that's a mortal sin. The person is, by doctrine, damned to eternal damnation in hell. But the nuns try to get the post death taken care of in a proper ecclesiastical way. They're willing to fudge every so often.
Yes, well, this nun who was the first to appear and is the first to appear for me as well, Sister Saint Savior. Nothing subtle.
I love
her
that
naming.
Name. I mean, there's a couple of regular. There's Sister Jean, Sister Lucy, but
right.
Sister Saint Savior.
Yes, and again, think about the fortitude, the internal life of a woman who takes a name like that. And she's been around for a long time. She's no nonsense, and she realizes that because Jim has committed suicide, that his widow will not be able to use the plot in a Catholic cemetery that they've already bought. Often at this time and place, the first thing a couple would do after they got married would go buy a cemetery plot, which I just love. It's like taking till death do us part, really, practically.
Yeah. Quite literally.
And where are we going to go?
We have the wedding. Okay,
right.
Now where do we end up?
Where we end up.
Right.
So she's already bought this plot, and Sister Saint Savior determines that if she can get him in the ground fast enough, the church will never know, and she can pull some strings. But the interesting thing for me, sort of stepping back from the scene itself, was the Catholic Church no longer has that rule. The Catholic Church understands in the 21st century that suicide is a product of mental illness. We're much more compassionate about it. And that rule was changed very subtly and quietly. And the nuns, the people who dealt with the people, understood that it was not Christ-like, and it was not an exercise of compassion to have a rule like that. And gradually, as the world changed, it changed. So when you talk about women priests, and even matters of birth control, I still have this glimmer of hope that those kinds of changes can still happen in a monolith, patriarchal institution like the church. After the church said, suicides can now be buried in consecrated ground, we didn't suddenly have a rash of suicides because now it's okay to commit suicide. The church says so. Although it was really about the characters when I wrote it, but when I step back from it, for me it became an illustration of the need to put compassion before dogma to have a moral life.
Do you mind my asking, would you call yourself a practicing Catholic? Do you go to Mass every week?
I practice, but not that well.
Uh-huh.
I'm hanging on. The gifts of the church still intrigue me and fill me with gratitude. The church also fills me with anger and dismay. But you could probably say that about most encounters with any people
or any institution.
Or any institution. Sure.
But it clearly and consciously informs your writing of this novel. But
very much,
you
so.
Know, the values of the church. And as you say, I mean, there's so much good that the Catholic Church has done historically, along with all sorts of stuff that I'm sure they'd like a do-over. But, you know, it informs your view of the world.
It does, and you know, more and more, and I think this is something that, again, was very much on my mind when I was composing this novel. It's, I don't know where else we talk about suffering, the inevitability of it. We talk about alleviating it. We talk about helping people who are suffering in various ways. But to be human is to suffer. That is absolutely provable. Mm-hmm. And then there's a great injustice in how suffering, as one of the nuns, is sort of her theodicy of why there's evil in the world. It's suffering is spread unevenly, unexpectedly. A good life suddenly ends in disaster. And, you know, Christianity and Catholicism confronts that and makes that in many ways central to the promises it makes and to any contemplation of what it is to be a human being. And I don't know where else I would go to find that kind of language that understands that and in some ways, maybe wrongheadedly, stands against it, says no.
Wrongheadedly?
Yeah.
How?
Well,
just because it's hopeless?
Maybe, you know, the title of the book, The Ninth Hour, comes from the Liturgy of the Hours, the daily prayers. The Ninth Hour is about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. In the Old Testament tradition, it was the time of sacrifice. In the New Testament, it's the time that Christ dies on the cross. And it occurred to me, and again, this only came through the composition of the novel, that right at that moment, that hour, that Christ dies on the cross, all is uncertain for believer and unbeliever alike. What's next? Was he just a man and now he's dead? It's just stillness. Even for the non-believer, is something going to happen now that's going to show that I was wrong to say he was just a man? And in some ways, I think that parallels the general sense of religious faith in the 21st century. I think in some ways, we're all holding our breath.
Absolutely. And that's really fascinating. The Ninth Hour is also sometimes referred to as the Hour of Great Mercy.
Mm-hmm.
Which I only happen to know because my daughter, who's a playwright, wrote a play that's called The Hour of Great Mercy.
Wonderful.
And she tells me, she who was raised in the Presbyterian Church, is a better expert on Catholicism than her Catholic dad, tells me that The Hour of Great Mercy is sometimes considered, because it was the hour of Jesus' death, to be the hour in which God is most receptive to prayer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's fascinating. But it's that doubt, too, or that wondering, and the nuns, like everybody else, have their moments where they think, gosh, is this really what's going on here? I mean, there's one nun who, having lived this incredibly amazing life as a person of nothing but service, doubts whether or not she'll end up in heaven.
Oh, she's convinced she won't.
Yes.
Yeah, convinced. She's lost it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that was an amazing, amazing scene to think, well, gosh, if you don't end up in heaven, boy, what are my chances? Zip, you know?
But she's someone, and actually was one of the most difficult nuns for me to make believable, because she has such a confident and strong faith in afterlife, in all the promises of Christianity. And because she believes in them so thoroughly, she can believe just as thoroughly that she has done something to lose them. There's Sally, who is the child of the suicide, thinks she has a vocation and finds out she doesn't in the course of the novel. But she has a moment when she witnesses the stillness that occurs in that moment after someone has died. And that's where her sense of, I don't know what to do next, infuses her life.
Yeah. That's a wonderful notion, that moment of uncertainty, which in fact carries with us every moment of our
Absolutely.
Breathing time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Unless we have this great faith. And yeah. But if we have the great faith, that also means we can lose. Not only do we stop being doubtful, but we have to acknowledge there's something wonderful that I might not get.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's tempered throughout this novel with a sort of realism, I guess, which is the best word for it, on the part of the nuns. At one point, you describe this, and I think this is not only really perceptive as a piece of intellectual endeavor, but it's also beautiful writing, a cold, distant sort of pity. So this is a nun taking care of somebody, a cold, distant sort of pity, like a bit of cool shade offered by an outcropping of granite.
She's a tough one.
She is a tough one. Is that Sister St. Xavier? I'm trying to remember.
That's
who
Sister Lucy.
Oh, Sister Lucy. Okay. And first of all, a cool shade offered, a bit of cool shade offered by an outcropping of granite. I hit that word granite and I just yell. Oh my gosh, who would think of granite as a thing creating shade? That's just fantastic.
In the desert.
In the desert, yeah. Right. And so, but it everything is, sure, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to do what you need to have done. But, I'm not getting suckered by you. I'm not getting sucker punched.
No, yeah. And Sister Lucy is sort of a interesting in that she is the one nun in this order who would have preferred to join a cloistered order.
Right.
She, her faith all resides
where
in
the imaginary.
Where
you don't get out, you just do all, it's well, all prayer.
She, exactly, yeah. As a child, she is dragged through churches in Chicago by a grandmother who's trying to save the soul of Lucy's father, who's just a tax collector, but we know where they end up. And for Lucy, it's the images of Christ on the cross, of the Stations of the Cross, of the paintings of Jesus and Mary. That's where reality resides.
Yeah.
And all this other stuff she has very little patience for, but she also knows all this other stuff requires someone to take care of it, and she's the one who can do that.
It also struck me the centrality of Catholicism for this community of people. I mean, the novel does hop out of the early 20th century in Brooklyn, and we hear a little bit about later generations throughout the book. But the church was everything. The rules were the rules. Everybody knew what they were. You knew when you were breaking them. You knew what the consequences were of breaking them. And it was just, you didn't take a breath without saying, okay, is this allowed or not allowed? And it's interesting because like myself, there's been so many people who have chosen to leave the church. What do you think accounts for that, this sort of mass defection of organized religion in general? The Catholics are certainly not the only ones experiencing that now, but the Pew research on religion mm-hmm. will tell you that, just a small percentage of people maintain the faith, a tradition in which they were raised.
Yes.
What accounts for that?
Oh, that's for the social scientists and the theologians to figure out. I mean, I'm sure that there's something of just the general breakdown of community. Churches provided a ready-made community. I think because we're so busy, because there are so many other things absorbing our time, that the kind of contemplative, quiet reading that's necessary to maintain faith, to keep it under consideration, it just is not there for us. And I find this as a somewhat public Catholic, I think there's been this misconception, and the churches have certainly done a lot to encourage it in the past, that to be a person of faith is to shut out all other possibilities, to always be confident, to be dogmatic, not to entertain doubt. And the most faithful people I know are full of doubt.
Yeah, me They're
too. They're always questioning. And that's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
Because if you're questioning, you're thinking. And you're reading and you're listening and you're observing and you're open to grace and surprise. But if you're sure, you've cut all that out.
Yeah, and of course, openness to grace is a prerequisite for getting grace.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, fun. We're going to come back and talk some more. Alice McDermott, she's the best-selling author of 8 novels, including Charming Billy, Someone, and After This. She is on the faculty of Johns Hopkins University. Her latest novel, published just last month, is called The Ninth Hour. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay there. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, a reminder that if you are a lover of literary fiction, I've been blessed to have had conversations with some terrific writers recently. Madison Smart Bell was here, James McBride, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and Elizabeth Strout. They've all spent time with us here on Midday. And you can hear those conversations on our podcast or at wipr.org/midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is another terrific novelist, Alice McDermott. She's the winner of the National Book Award, or a winner of the National Book Award. They do hand out more than one of those every so often. And her books have been finalists for the Pulitzer Prize, the Penn Faulkner Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and the Dublin Impact Award, among others. She's on the faculty of the writing seminars at Johns Hopkins, and she's here with me today in Studio A. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and to find us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. Teresa in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Alice McDermott.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great, thanks.
Good. I had the pleasure of seeing you, Alice, at the Baltimore Book Fair, and totally enjoyed your presentation and have already read the book. So
thank you.
I have one question, if you can, without spoiling it for others. Can you talk a little bit about that scene at the end with Sally and I think with Sister Lucille, Louise, when they were caring for Miss Costello, and Miss Costello passed away?
Yes.
And the reader was left with, like, I have my thoughts about it, but I'm curious as to your thoughts. Was, did Sister Louise, and I think she believed that she let her die, or did Sally, by her action?
Well, that's a tough one to talk about without spoiling, without the spoiler alert. I understand what you're saying, Teresa. That's a tough one. How do you want to wiggle out of that one, Alice?
Well, apparently this conversation has taken place in book clubs already. I've heard from a number of people who've discussed it with friends and in book clubs. And that scene, it's in the chapter called Still, has been a subject of some debate, but a member of a book club wrote to me and said that she clarified the debate in her book club by saying, Alice doesn't put any details in her novels that don't absolutely have to be there. And in that scene, applesauce has lumps, and applesauce is not inherently lumpy. So if Alice put lumps in the applesauce, she did it for a reason. So that might be the clue that you're looking for.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Teresa. And now welcome back to everybody who hasn't read the novel.
Right.
Because, boy, if ever there were a cryptic conversation, it was that one.
There you go.
Yeah, this book, it's your eighth bite of the apple. And this whole noveling thing.
So to speak.
I think it is an absolute masterpiece. I really do. And I wonder if you think that your artistry, your craft, your understanding of how to do this is considerably advanced from when you were 40 or 30. I mean, you and I are about the same age. We're in our 60s. It's not a matter of better or worse, you know, I think, but it is a matter of sort of authority and control. I mean, do you have a sense that your authority as a writer is a little deeper now? I mean, is this a book you could have written when you were 30 years old?
Oh, my. You know, in some ways, every time I start a new piece of fiction, I feel like a novice. You know, here we go. I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea how I'm going to tell this story. I have no idea once I start telling it if I'm making any sense. I think maybe I have a sense of knowing what I'm about sooner in the process, understanding what to look for in my own writing so that I can make the most of it. But this novel in particular, in some ways I was cloistered writing it. I had not shown any of it to my editor. The first chapter was published as a short story in The New Yorker, and that's the first my editor saw of what I was about. And when I sent it to him, I absolutely had no idea what his reaction might be and whether he would just say, a book about nuns. Oh, Alice, what else have you got? So I don't know that you get any more confidence, but I think there is a sense of maybe raising your own stakes. Maybe, you know, that notion of there's not a detail in here that is not absolutely necessary to the entire structure. That sense of I'm making choices here that I understand, and I hope the reader is with me understanding. The novel, for instance, is told from the 21st century point of view of Sally's children, but it's not about them. And that was a very conscious decision on my part. You know, again, you make it and you keep your fingers crossed. Reader, stay with me. I promise you I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, oh, you definitely
do that.
So maybe
the confidence to say that is better now than it might have been.
And the interregnum between your last book and the book before that, Someone, was about 7 years.
Yes.
And the interregnum between that one and this one is 3 years shorter. It's four years. I remember the last time we talked, you said that somebody asked you, what do you do in between those times? You know, what have we been doing for the last 7 years?
Right.
You know, when this book comes out, and you said, I've been writing the book.
Right.
You know? Should we read anything into that? Did this one come more easily to you?
Oh, gosh, no.
It's a lot shorter. 3 years is a lot shorter.
It is. Well, I got my kids out of the house. That could have helped.
Yeah, that helps. Right. We have an email here from Elaine who says, I heard Ms. McDermott do a reading at the Baltimore Book Festival a few years ago, and during the Q&A, someone asked whether her characters are based on her own family. And from the other side of the tent, someone shouted, no, they're based on mine. So doesn't that say it all, that we find so much that is universal and recognizable in her writing? That's astute.
Very nice. Yeah, thank you.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
The notion that that a story like this can be told with, one of the things that really excited me about this book, which I purposely read in small chunks. Mm-hmm. I did not sit down and read it on a Saturday because it was like chocolate for dessert. I just wanted to save a special part of the day. The notion that you could sustain the tenderness of this book through the whole book, I thought was a great achievement. Were you conscious of that? Because as a reader, I was conscious that it was tender and gentle on every page, even in on pages where stuff happens.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, I'm reading this in the context of, you know, Harvey Weinstein and the President of the United States and this vulgarity that swirls around us in the real world. But to escape in your novel, there is a gentleness to that. And I wonder if that's something that, you know, as you edited it and went back and rewrote and crafted, mm-hmm. that was something you were conscious of.
Well, I think it's part of sort of trying to create character against type, and part of trying to understand each and every character, not just the religious sisters, but each character, to try to understand them as fully human. So flawed in some ways and blind in some ways, but doing the best she can or doing the best he can with circumstances that are often beyond his or her control. So in some ways, it goes back to that opposite of sentimental, to recognize all their flaws and all their negative human characteristics, but at the same time to try to forgive them for those things in recognition that we're all kind of doing the best we can.
Yeah.
And that faith fails us sometimes and our best intentions fail us quite often. And also this sort of looking back that the narrators are doing to forgive the past. This novel started not to be a novel about nuns. That my first
it was about the Civil War.
Was to write about substitutes in the Civil War, or to make something
which
of
I
that.
Didn't even know was a thing. That's really interesting.
Yes, yeah, just that, and again, it's not terribly different from what happened in Vietnam and even the 21st century military. That during the Civil War, families or individuals could pay someone else to go and fight
in their
the
stead.
Union Army in their stead. Which, you know, just fascinated me and you know, led to thoughts about, well, then how much gratitude do you have to have? If someone has gone and either given their life or lost limbs so that someone else, maybe wealthier or better educated, can go on and have a full life and procreate, well, then that person's children's lives are made possible by the substitute. And on and on. How long do you go looking back and saying, gee, thanks, I owe you. And so in some ways, what I was trying to do with the novel was to, without approaching the subject directly, to get a sense of how do we forgive each other? How far back do we forgive? When do we hold things against each other? And when do we say, okay? Because, I mean, in the religious aspect, their Sister Jean is a nun who says, I've done something I can't be forgiven for. And everything about my life would disintegrate if I were forgiven for this. Because I've taken something that I had no right to take. So I wanted that sense of kindness and forgiveness and no doubt what was going on in the world, as much as you try to lock it out of your room when you're writing, it seeps in.
Sure.
No doubt that sense of can we be good to each other? Honestly, and can we forgive each other even for terrible things, honestly, even unto other generations?
And one of the phrases that is repeated a few times is love's a tonic, not a cure. You know, that it's more than just love.
Yes.
It takes love in conjunction with hard work sometimes.
To
fix things. And then, as you say, there's some things maybe don't ever get fixed.
Yeah, I mean, and the irony of that line is that it comes from a devout Catholic woman, but it's the exact opposite of what Christianity tells us. Christianity says love redeems us.
Yes. It is the cure.
It is the cure. Yeah. Right? Yeah. She doesn't think so.
I was also taken, and we just have a few seconds left, but one of your characters, actually one of the men, says, we all die at the same time. At the end of our lives.
Yes.
I mean, and isn't that true?
Yeah, so why worry?
Right. So on that uplifting note, we're going to call it quits for today, but it's
thank
so
you,
terrific
Tom.
To see you, and thank you so much for this book. It's just it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. The experience of reading it is a wonderful thing.
Thank you so much.
All right, great to see you. Alice McDermott, the new novel is called The Ninth Hour. She will read from this wonderful book in two events in Baltimore in just the next couple of weeks, on November 6th and also on November 28th, both of those events on the Hopkins Homewood campus. Come to WIPR.org/midday, and we've got a link to information on the details. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, the alarming rise of hate crimes on college campuses. White nationalists marching on the campus of the University of Virginia. The stabbing death last spring of a Black Bowie State student. Frequent incidents of swastikas painted in dormitories. More students are feeling less safe on college campuses across the country. We'll talk about it tomorrow with Lawrence Ross, the author of Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses, and Ashley Vasquez. She's a University of Maryland student and activist. Plus, we're going to talk to an artist whose work is being juxtaposed with the collection at the Maryland Historical Society to explore race, gender, and bias. That's coming up tomorrow right here on Midday. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.